Thank you, Peter, and I would like to invite Chris Pearson to respond to Peter's lecture. Chris is a senior lecturer at the School of Humanities and Communication Studies at the University of Western Sydney. Chris.
Thank you, Dimitri. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening, charged with the responsibility of responding to Peter Zendi's lectures on iconomy, the circulation of images. I have been reading Professor Zendi's work for the past several years, and on each occasion, my respect and interest for his work has accrued considerably. I think that Zendi possesses an uncanny ability to bring together a wide range of sources and eclecticism that has him pulling from many different directions at once, from musicology to film, from philosophy to literature. I am tempted to read him as a kind of philosopher pickpocket who, like the protagonist in the eponymous film of Bresson, has many different assets and reserves at his fingertips. The virtuosic transactions displayed in the film, where money and images circulate almost magically from one character to another, seem to function, in other words, as a kind of allegory for Zendi's own scholarly approach that moves seamlessly and effortlessly from one scene or image to the next. Where Zendi suggests that, quote, what Michel and the other pickpockets are attempting to grasp under the name or under the sign of money is exchange as such, the always disappearing instant of pure exchange, which has to be nabbed if it were possible, which has to be caught as it flies by in order to wrest it from the darkness where it is constantly plunging again, end quote. I can only attempt to seize upon a few select images or scenes from Zendi's undoubtedly rich analysis. It is in fact this particular scene of attempting to grasp the ungraspable, the pure moment of exchange that always draws away from view, to which I am especially drawn. Yet what does it mean to be drawn to a scene that stages the potentially infinite withdrawal and circulation of money and images? That this scene is a particularly famous one from Bresson's film means that many spectators have found themselves equally drawn to the images it presents of images sliding in and out of view. What sort of desire or pleasure does this staging of incessant seizing and losing afford? Zendi implies that the motivation of the pickpockets depicted in the film extends beyond the mere desire to possess the various things that money can buy. What I want to ask is quite simply what it means to say that pickpockets desire, in addition to accruing wealth, quote, the always disappearing instant of pure exchange, end quote. What desire, in other words, might be satisfied should one manage to seize this pure moment of exchange? Even if the moment of pure exchange is always ungraspable, what does one seek to attain? And are we truly speaking about the desire of the intra-diegetic characters, or rather that of the extra-diegetic spectator, who takes pleasure in viewing this succession of filmic images that seems to comment on its own self-constitution as much as it does on the theft of images that it depicts? Does spectatorship make us all into virtual pickpockets who take great pleasure in witnessing such spectacles of possession and dispossession, precisely because they enact at safe distance a dispossession inherent in images themselves? As exchange values, values that, as Bresson puts it, wield power only in relation to other images, values that have no absolute value in and by themselves, images, whether moving or so-called still, are in fact always on the move, are always slipping in and out of our hands. In the interview that Joe Joannese conducted with Peter for the Philosopher's Zone, they briefly discussed the social media phenomenon of the selfie and its relationship to the heightened circulation of images in contemporary life. And it seems to me that in addition to its characteristically rapid transmission, the selfie also conceals and reveals a certain irony. Its production does not require anyone's assistance to snap the photo. Its invention is entirely self-enclosed. Yet one willingly disseminates this image across the internet, fully aware that its circulation cannot be managed or controlled. While there are debates about what constitutes a true selfie, its production typically requires that the camera never leave the hands of the self who captures the image. Clutching the prosthetic apparatus that will facilitate the image's release, one can perhaps thereby cling to the fantasy that the image has never and will never leave one's hands, that it will remain present at hand, immunized against its spatial and temporal displacement. One gives oneself over to an unknown alterity with an image of the self, whose condition of production seems designed precisely to militate against the self-dispossession occasioned by its communication for all to see. This economic return to the self-same, to the I who originally captured the image, turns us toward a different sort of I-economy, understood both as the self from whom the image first issues, as well as the innumerable gazes to which the image may be subjected, beginning with the union formed by one's anatomical eye and the camera's mechanical equivalent, a partnership that conditions the selfie's apprehension. Is this remaining present at hand precisely what the pickpockets desire to capture in the always disappearing instant of pure exchange? The French language affords an eloquently economic means of expressing the possibility of a graspable self-presence with the word maintenant, or now, the present that one literally holds in one's hands. Is this attempt to grasp the now precisely where pickpocketing and the phenomenon of the selfie join hands? Does the instance of pure exchange thereby amount to only one side of the coin, whose reverse reveals precisely a desire for the unexchangeable or unchangeable, a desire to cling to what is always already slipping away, namely the self-present moment or time itself? Since I am keenly aware that the time allotted for my response is also rapidly slipping by, I want to quickly exchange the image of the selfie with that of the virtual currency known as Bitcoin, a decentralized peer-to-peer network of exchange that issues no banknotes, coins, or even plastic cards, those material objects that are constantly being swapped in the film clips that we viewed this evening. Does Bitcoin name the advent of an utterly non-iconic economy? While Bitcoins can be stolen, laundered, or pickpocketed, could one make a film about them? How would one go about visually representing the act of pickpocketing a virtual currency? Whereas in Bresson, the flattening of images seems to permit banknotes to slip from inside the film to its exterior, as well as facilitate a more general mode of transformation of images into many different others. The image of a virtual currency, if it finally has one at all, is one that seems to have been pressed into tiny bits, indeed into infinitesimal pieces of digital code that thwart representation altogether. This is not to say that Bitcoins are utterly imageless. One can no doubt imagine their taking up space on numerous hard drives around the world, no matter how intangible our imaginative representations of those coins may be. This is also not to presume that paper money is entirely non-virtual. Insofar as the paper on which a banknote is printed is not the source of its value, money, of course, has always possessed a virtual dimension. Surprisingly, the commentaries I have read on the subject of bitcoins rarely acknowledge the intrinsic redundancy of the phrase virtual currency. And it's in light of this lack of recognition that I will end with the following question. If all currencies are virtually virtual, then how is this virtuality further transformed in the context of a spectral currency that leaves its traces both everywhere and nowhere? And with that, I'll turn things back over to Dimitri, who's over there. Thanks.
So I was wondering whether Peter would like to respond to Chris.
Yes, thank you. I don't know if I really have a precise answer to all these questions, fascinating questions actually. The question of the selfie and what you described as its not only its rapid transmission and circulation, But what you described as its economy and its return to the self-same, right? Which sounds really interesting as a way of looking at the selfie. And then the Bitcoin that you mentioned, with its non-iconic economy, or its possibly non-iconic dimension. So this made me think that obviously it's a very interesting question to ask. Are there non-iconic economies? And this is the question that you ask. I'm not sure that I have an answer. What I'm sure is that on the contrary, or seen from the reverse side or point of view, the iconic is economic. So I'm not quite sure if there are non-iconic economies, but what I'm sure about is that the iconic as such is economic, and that's what I tried to develop. Yes, maybe, but I don't want to speak too much. I've spoken already so much, so if there are questions.
I was actually wondering whether roaming microphone is... there! That's why I stood up before. I just couldn't figure out what was happening. Okay, so the floor is open for questions. Are there any questions that people would like to ask?
Thank you so much for that. Very enjoyable. And I just wanted to pick up on a few of the ideas that you mentioned in terms of the potential way that they relate. And you mentioned the fold a number of times, both of clothing and of newspapers, particularly in the clips. And that made me think of the Deleuzean model of the fold and the way that that becomes a framework for which we can think of something both within and without at the same time. And you mentioned that in the clips, money was moving from our vision and then into the fold of the newspaper, where it then almost symbolized being without the screen or non-diegetic, which then related well to the diegetic and non-diegetic idea as well. And I'm just wondering then if in that idea of the money moving into the newspaper, there is that idea of money within the film and without the film when it's employed in such a way by a filmmaker.
Oh, thank you. That's a wonderfully precise question and very, I mean, to the point. Right? Yes, the fold, actually, obviously, I must have had Deleuze in mind somewhere in the back of my mind. But as you mentioned, the question of the fold is that folding is really a way of including the outside in the inside or vice versa. And what I really had in mind with all these scenes that I showed you, where money goes out of the diegetic world or remains stuck outside, as when in Bresson's L'Argent the door closes, and you know the other side of images remains outside. And then it's sort of folded back, or it comes back in the inside. And the same with pickpocket. So what I really had in mind was maybe more, if I think of another philosopher who is very important to me, the category of what Jacques Derrida called the quasi-transcendental. Quasi-transcendental, meaning that you know, what is transcendental makes something possible, but doesn't belong to the plane or the space or the world of what it makes possible. It makes it possible, but it's outside. Now, what Derrida calls the quasi-transcendental would be a transcendental, in the sense of a condition of possibility, something that makes this image world, for example, possible, but that at the same time is sort of folded in it or on it, so it belongs to the very series that it makes possible. So that's, in a way, the role of money in all these films, and this is how we can understand the way that the fact that money is at the same time, or maybe not at the same time, maybe you know, sometimes outside or behind or as the condition of possibility of all the images, and then it folds in them, on them. This is why I think when Deleuze writes that every film on money is already a film about the film, so it's already a film about the condition of possibility of film, which, as I said at the beginning, a film is much more than a film. I mean, I will come back to that maybe on Wednesday or Friday. So the filmic experience is not just confined in the movie theater. Watching, looking, gazing is already an archy filmic experience. I mean, in just to say a few words about that, maybe you suffice it to say, as Walter Murch, who maybe you know, he was the editor of Francis Coppola for many of Coppola's wonderful movies, like The Godfather or The Conversation, a wonderful film. So Walter Murch, he wrote a brilliant book on editing, actually. The title of the book is In the Blink of an Eye. And he states quite simply, in very simple terms, that when you look, when you shift your gaze, and when you are blinking, which we always do, then you are already editing what you are seeing. You know, it's quite simple and obvious. So we are constantly editing, and you could notice that in some precise, specific moments. For example, if you are moved, if you are anxious, stressed, if you have a sort of empathy with the person whom you're listening to or whom you're watching speaking, then maybe you move your eyes, you blink your eyes in a quicker pace or slowly, etc. So the editing of the visual is always going on and is always active. So that's just to say that the filmic experience is much more as a model or as a paradigm, much more than what goes on in a movie theater. Now, if we speak of films about film, as Deleuze says, I think this would be really close to the idea of a quasi-transcendental. So the condition of possibility for the film to be, which would be money or the... what money is the name of, that is to say the exchangeability of images, that's what makes a film possible as such. And this condition of possibility is re-inscribed, so it becomes noticeable, it is remarked, or it is staged in the world of the film. This is what we see in Bresson's Money, etc. So maybe we could translate... I don't know if they are strictly equivalent, I would doubt that, but there is some possible parallel between Deleuze's notion of the fold, Derrida's notion of the remark, this sort of restaging in the inside of the outer conditions of possibility, etc. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you put your finger on exactly what I had in mind, so the fold as this folding of the outside onto the inside and vice versa. Thank you. Yep.
Just wondering, following on from the concept of money being both transcendental, very much tactile. The tech industry is going through what they're calling the mediated reality. It's a transition of digital into physical, partially through the way 3D printers. smart glasses are coming ahead as well in that regard, overlaying digital realities into physical. And I was wondering from a cinematographic point of view if there's a chance we might actually see other objects also come in and satisfy this criteria that money currently has, and what your opinion is on that.
Thank you. Well, I guess this connects with Chris's question, no? About Bitcoin, right? So, if I understood your question correctly, but you correct me if I didn't, the question would be, could we imagine ways of representing in cinema this principle of exchangeability that money is, that money stands for, the general equivalent, as Marx famously said. So money would be the general equivalence of images, right? That would be its role in movies. So could we imagine stagings of this general equivalence of images in other forms, in other shapes, other figures than bills, be they dollars or francs? Well, I would say it's very difficult to pin down, as I said, the very exchangeability of images. So money, basically, when money, that would be the right answer, or a part of a partial answer. When money appears on the recto side of images, then it becomes an image among others, right? So by appearing in the cine world, money becomes an image, and becoming an image, it sort of reveals, of course, the exchangeability of images, but at the same time, it immediately hides it because it becomes an image among others. So maybe the question behind your question, so to speak, would be how could we represent this fugacious moment par excellence that exchange or exchangeability is in a more dematerialized way than paper money, right? But I would say the question of dematerialization and the possibility of grasping, seizing, representing this dematerialized moment of pure exchange is impossible because as soon as you represent it, be it by paper money or whatever else, bitcoins, if you start imagining them, then as soon as you represent them, the very fact of representing them immediately hides what they are representing, what they are standing for, except for the fold. Right, which takes us back to the previous question. So the fold, the what I call the borrowing from Duchamp. I don't know if you know this wonderful expression by Marcel Duchamp, the artist. What he called inframince, so infra thin. So this almost this quasi unthickness, but still minimally layered, this would be the representation, but at the same time non-representation. So this would be the quasi exchangeability seized or grasped as such, but immediately disappearing. Right? So then, if you put on these images of paper money, of you know, lines of calculus on computers, or etc. Basically, it comes to the same. You represent something that is immediately disappearing.
Please, Alex.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful talk. I've got a small question about which I feel you may actually answer in your upcoming lectures, but. Why you've taken cinema as your model and not, say, television? Your own example was from The Sopranos, a really, really strong example, but I'm thinking of contemporary examples. I mean, Bresson was some time ago, you have to admit. Think of well, as fantastic as it is, think of The Wire recently. Fantastic example of course, you know, money and commodification and so forth. Game of Thrones right now. Things like this. Sopranos, your own example. I mean, they strike me as the current very, very strong examples of what you're talking about. So I wonder first if there's any kind of distinction that you're drawing between cinema and television here. And I suppose, yeah, just why television isn't your model.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's a really important question. I hope I won't disappoint you if I say that for me there is absolutely no difference between cinema and television. one way of justifying this is already included in what I too briefly and too quickly indicated at the beginning of the lecture when I talked of archi cinema. So if we say, be it with Deleuze or with Nancy or with Lyotard, or, you know, you can draw on many theories of the cinematic. If we say that cinema is immediately more than cinema, cinema is the name for experience, for the world, for the structure of the real, etc. So if you say that there is no extra film, meaning there is no outside of the film, then, you know, television or whatever screen you're looking at is already cinema in a way, or is still cinema already, or still, I don't know. Then once this said, of course, I'm very aware that I cannot brush aside, from a kind of philosophical overview, the huge difference between cinema and television, which is a real difference. Now, I won't be talking about this difference between television and cinema. I don't even know if I would be capable of thematizing this difference. When I will be talking about in the next lectures about exchange and debt, and the way our gaze contracts a debt when looking at images, I will be saying something in the last lecture about this famous essay that I mentioned already by Walter Benjamin, The Work of Art in the Age of Its Technical Reproducibility. There are many versions of the title. I will be saying something about what Walter Benjamin calls in German Gewöhnung, which is a word that you can hear as meaning a habit, but also an addiction almost already. So I won't be talking about television, but I will be talking about a certain regime of the circulation of images that Benjamin has in mind when he speaks about habit. This regime that is so akin to or close to what we call today binge watching, right? Which I am the first victim of it, you know. So binge watching, the fact that looking at television series you cannot stop, and each image that you see is already contracting for you, or you are contracting through it a debt to more and more coming images. So this very embodiment of the quick circulation, the rapid transmission, as you said, speaking of the selfie, this embodiment of the very quickness of exchange and of circulation that television series are, this will be sort of in the background of my discourse. Now, why didn't I take the model of television instead of the model of cinema? So here again, I could answer in two ways. Either I erase the difference between television and cinema, and I say, okay, I'm speaking of a kind of archy or general cinematography that already includes television. That would be one solution. If we would try to look for the specificity of the televisual model, I think we would be drawn back to the same question that was asked before, and to this this motive or theme that is sort of haunting us here, and the question of immediacy, the immediacy of exchange. With the whole question of television, if there is a difference between television and cinema, would be so-called real time. No? I mean, otherwise, what is the specificity of television? I wouldn't know. Because if you take a television series, you know, basically, is it so different from a film? I wouldn't really know the difference. Or if there is a difference, if there is still a difference, which is not so sure, because you know now you can nowadays you can watch television series like movies on DVDs, downloading them, Netflix, etc. But if there would be a difference, then it would be in the fact that television constrains you, obliges you to be there at the time when it is aired, right? So then we would be, and I won't explore that, but if we were to explore that, we should really question again the moment of the immediacy of the so-called real time of exchange. And that will be the topic of my next lecture on Wednesday. So the idea will be, is it possible, as the, all these pickpockets have tried to do, is it possible to seize, to grasp the very moment of exchange? So the very now, or as Chris would say, the maintenant, right, in French. This now that you hold with your hand.
Well, on this note, I think there is another time that we need to adhere to, which is the time of the closure of the library. we will have to be out by 8 o'clock, so we've got a few minutes to go out. But let me thank both Peter and Chris again. And we're looking forward to the second lecture on Wednesday, same time, same place.